All right, we are now here on the Saturday afternoon show. I am Tom Rowe. Let's see if we get these levels quite right. All right. Yes, it's Saturday afternoon. That's a little better. And I'm Tom Rowe. We're live from the Wave Farm in Acre today from 4 to 6 p.m. And later tonight, we want to tell you quickly before we get started, at 8, we'll be live from the Catskill Community Center with the WGXC Winter Pageant. A host of performers, all sorts of folks. Go to the website to see the whole list. And then at 11, we'll go to Chicago for Nerf B Radio, the latest edition of Nerf B Radio from Anna Fritz, Jeff Kolar, Johnny Farrow, and a host of others. So stay tuned all night for some great radio. Saturday Night Special and the Saturday Night Seance later tonight. But now it's time for the Saturday afternoon show, and I'm Tom Rowe. We're live from Wave Farm, and we have, via Skype, John Anderson there. John, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Oh, we can hear you just fine. Let's see. Great. I've got to turn you down a little bit even. John is the author of a new book, Radio's Digital Dilemma, Broadcasting in the 21st Century, from Rutledge. John Anderson also serves as the vice president on Wave Farm's board of directors and is assistant professor and director of broadcast journalism in the Department of Television and Radio at Brooklyn College in the City University of New York system, and a former radio journalist, perhaps still a radio journalist, and has been working in the media policy for two decades. Thanks for joining us today, John.
Thank you very much for having me, Tom.
Can you... let me turn this down a little bit. Can you tell us a little bit about your book?
Yeah, it's called Radio's Digital Dilemma, Broadcasting in the 21st Century. Just came out from Routledge, which was just published late last month, or mid-month actually, mid-December. And it's the first comprehensive and critical analysis of radio's digital transition in the United States. If you know, last decade, television transitioned from analog to digital broadcasting. There was a bunch of money involved at that. The Telecommunications Act of 1996 kind of kicked that off. And it took almost a decade for the transition to happen, but it did. So now we have higher definition pictures, better sound, the ability for TV broadcasters to actually transmit more than one program on a given channel. And HD radio is supposed to be radio's companion to that. The technologies were developed completely separately, using kind of a different way of developing and organizing support behind the technology. But this is a story that actually started back in the mid to late 1980s. HD radio has been on the air in the United States since 2002, so we're going into its 12th year on the air. And my book is kind of, I like to kind of call it an act of muck raking, in that I went into all of the various trade publications, FCC documents and dockets governing the digital transition, and really interrogated the actors behind it, why the technology developed the way that it did, and why the FCC approved it. And the book ends with kind of a state of play of where radio's digital transition stands right now, with some possible ideas about what we can do going forward to make the transition feasible. Because right now, radio's digital transition in the U.S. is kind of stuck for a variety of reasons.
And can you just tell the average listener where we are with digital radio right now? People may know with digital television that a couple years ago, your old analog TV with the antenna doesn't work anymore because they changed all the signals. Is anybody listening to us right now through digital means?
Well, not through HD radio. Unlike the television transition, where all broadcasters basically had to migrate their signals to a whole new part of the TV spectrum, which is why you needed to buy new TVs or get conversion boxes for your old TVs, radio's digital transition is using this technology called HD radio, which basically allows broadcasters to simultaneously transmit both an analog and a digital signal. The idea behind that is that it's not supposed to disrupt the existing legacy analog radio signal that you're listening to right now. But if you wanted to, you could go out and buy more equipment, hardware and software, and basically create digital sidebands adjacent to your analog signal, which would allow you to broadcast a digital signal, which sounds a little bit better than your analog signal, depending on if you're an AM or an FM station, and would also give you the ability to broadcast new streams of programming, which in and of itself sounds really great. But the problem is that HD radio is somewhat of a disruptive technology. It actually does cause interference to existing analog signals because it has to share the airwaves with the analog signal. It's compromised in exactly how much information it can provide, which ultimately affects the quality of HD signals. And most importantly, unlike most digital technologies, it comes with a perpetual Microsoft-style license fee. In the current system of broadcasting, WGXC applies to the FCC, and it gets a license to use the public airwaves. Once you have that license, you have to go out and buy the equipment to put the signal on the air. But at that point, permission, gatekeeper permission to use the airwaves is already settled. In the HD radio world, WGXC has to go to the FCC and get permission to use the public airwaves, which you've already done because you're on the air. But then if you wanted to broadcast in digital, you'd have to enter into a contractual license agreement with a company called Ubiquiti Digital Corporation and pay them a not insignificant amount of money to effectively use their technology. And it's a lot like Microsoft in that If you do something that infringes on Microsoft's rights, Microsoft has the ability to yank the permission for you to use the software, which means in the HD radio world, the gatekeeper function is split between the FCC and between this private corporation. And that is wholly unprecedented. So no, you can't listen to WGXC in HD because your station has decided to opt out of making the investment and entering into this arrangement with Ubiquiti Digital. And you are actually in the majority of broadcasters in the United States, only about which 15% have actually adopted HD radio. The other 85% of radio stations in the United States have basically said, forget it, we don't want to play.
And it's not necessarily as much opting out as not even being able to get in terms of the level of to get in for a station on a low budget like with only 78,000 possible listeners, it's a little too high to jump through.
In many respects, if you were going to go HD on WGXC, just the cost of installing the equipment, the license fees to Ubiquiti, all the remedial changes you'd have to make to the way your station is set up in order for it to effectively broadcast an HD signal, that's more than your whole operating budget for the entire year. So it's not something that's feasible for smaller, non-commercial radio stations.
And that's with a payoff. What is the payoff? What percentage of listeners have HD equipment or could use the digital signal in some way?
Well, that's a good question, and there really isn't a solid answer to that. The only information that we have on the number of HD radios that exist that allow people to actually listen to an HD signal comes from Ubiquiti Digital Corporation, and it's kind of difficult to confirm their numbers. What they're saying is that there are about 15 million HD radio receivers that are in circulation in the United States that have been sold since 2002. 15 million receivers since 2002. And if you consider that the number of radio receivers in the United States is estimated by the consumer electronics industry to be something like 600 to 700 million, we're basically talking single-digit percentage of people that can actually listen to HD. Right about now, there are over 242 million Americans that listen to radio on a weekly basis, and about 3 to 6 million of those actually do some of their radio listening in HD. So we're talking close to a percent, maybe 2% of listeners actually listening to an HD radio signal.
And those listeners are probably in cars?
Yeah, the majority of those listeners are in cars. About 85% of the installed HD radio receiver base are in automobiles, and they were bought not by people that wanted to go out and find out this brave new world of HD radio. It's just because they bought a new car and it happened to have HD radio in it. So even the number of receivers that are sold doesn't necessarily represent a metric that we can then use to say, oh, this technology is actually finding adoption by radio listeners. Because if you actually go around and ask people, what is HD radio? You're going to get a couple of different responses. One person might say, oh, that's satellite radio. That's Sirius and XM. Another person might say, well, that's just the internet. Like, the internet is where you find HD radio streaming and Pandora and Spotify and things like that. But the actual number of American radio listeners that actually know the technology is around is probably about 60-ish percent. And that number's actually been dropping over several years because broadcasters simply haven't adopted the technology, and those that have aren't really promoting it.
And so it's actually a situation where someone listening to us right now might not realize that they have digital radio available to them in their car as they're driving around, but that's what they actually have.
Yeah. The way that HD radio works is because there's an analog signal and then digital sidebands attached to it, is when your radio tunes to an HD radio station, it first tunes to the analog signal. So it sounds just like normal AM or FM radio would. And then once the radio receives enough information, kind of like streaming, you know, your computer has to buffer the amount of information that it gets before it can start playing it back, then you start hearing a slightly higher quality signal that's pretty much the same programming that you heard on the analog side. If your station has the ability to stream multiple channels, once the digital signal is locked in, then you're presented with the option of, do you want to listen to channel 1, channel 2, or channel 3? Those side channels, those extra programs, do not have an analog fallback. So just like when you're streaming something online and the network gets congested, the signal just silences, just drops out until the radio can buffer enough bits so that you can hear it again. It's pretty interesting in new cars, specifically in BMW cars, there have been so many complaints of analog and digital signals flipping back and forth because it's hard to hold on to that digital signal that people think that their radio is broken. So they've been going to the BMW dealership and saying, hey, what's wrong with my radio? It keeps dropping in and out. I don't know what's going on. And BMW has actually sent out a bulletin to all of their mechanics, saying that if you ever receive a complaint like this, the easiest way to fix it is to simply turn off the HD function of the radio. So it's not something that blows your mind away when you start suddenly hearing this new digital programming, because it doesn't really sound all that much better than what you can get on analog.
So you're actually saying that sometimes people, the first time they hear about digital radio is when they're told to turn it off.
Yeah, but it's not that your radio is broken. It's because the radio signal is broken. So if we just turn off the part of the receiver that receives the digital signal, then your radio will sound fine.
Now, one phrase you used in there was that it's so difficult to receive. Now, it seems counterintuitive to me that a new system, new digital system moving from analog to digital, and it would be more difficult to receive. It would seem to be that would be the capability that you were trying to build in.
Yeah, that is an inherent compromise to HD radio that's caused by the fact that it has to share spectrum with both the analog signal and with any digital neighbors. Going back into history, back in the late 80s, in the mid-80s, actually, Europe was developing its own digital radio standard. And it was going to work a lot like digital television would. It's going to use a whole new part of spectrum, and all the radio stations are going to just broadcast in digital on this new spectrum, which prevents this kind of interference that we're talking about from happening. the United States actually was prepared to adopt the European digital radio system. But at the time, the spectrum on which it worked was being used by the Pentagon, basically for missile test and flight telemetry purposes. And the broadcast industry actually made some moves to try to take that spectrum away from the Pentagon, but the military-industrial complex is not to be trifled with, and they wouldn't give up the spectrum. And that basically forced the United States' radio industry to essentially create their own homegrown technology, and that's how we ended up with HD radio. So what has effectively happened is you've expanded the footprint of every radio station on the dial. So, for example, if you're broadcasting at, say, 90.7 FM, your signal actually extends 200 kilohertz away. That's why the dial is in odd numbers, 97.1, 90.3, 90.5, 90.7, because you need that space in between each radio station in order to fit the signal. And what digital has done has put additional information on the outside edges of that signal. So instead of your station on 90.7 broadcasting from 90.8 to, say, 90.6, it actually broadcasts all the way from 90.9 to 90.5. And if there are stations located somewhere on those two adjacent channels, your digital sidebands bleed over onto their analog signal. And so because of that, in order to accommodate this brand new energy on the AM and FM dials, the digital signal is actually broadcast at just 1 to 10% of the analog level of your radio station. So let's say you broadcast with a station that has 10,000 watts of analog power. That basically means that your digital signal can only run anywhere from, like, you know, 100 to 1,000 watts. Basic physics shows you that a 1,000-watt signal is not going to be as robust as a 10,000-watt signal. And simply because there was no new spectrum on which to put a new digital radio service, analog and digital radio, HD radio, have been forced to coexist. And that's one of the fundamental weaknesses of the HD radio system.
And when television moved, it actually switched from one part of the frequency to a different set of airwaves. So it's not sharing the old channel 6 currently. It's at a whole new place.
Yes, that's correct. Basically, as part of the Telecommunications Act of 1996, Congress gave television broadcasters somewhere upwards of $60 billion worth of new spectrum on which to deploy these new HD TV signals. Now, the old analog channels are being consolidated by the FCC, and the FCC plans to resell that spectrum to telecommunications companies, phone companies, cable companies, and things like that, to provide wireless broadband internet access. So yeah, if you tune into an old channel 5, you won't see an analog signal on there anymore because the station has moved to a new part of the spectrum, which means that that spectrum is now free to be used for other things.
Now, do you know, can you pick up cell phone calls with old televisions?
No, I don't think so. Partially because old televisions are designed to receive analog signals, and digital signals sound a lot different. Actually, they sound like noise on an analog receiver. It can be a high-pitched whine, a kind of a squeal, things like that. So if you've got an analog radio and there are HD radio signals where you live, if you tune through the dial, you'll be able to hear this kind of buzzing noise adjacent to the stations that are running HD radio signals, and that's the digital information.
There it is. There's the digital information. I'm going through the dial. Now, another thing you said I wanted to ask about was that it was sending like a different signal on the same signal. And that's something that transmission has done for years, these kind of sidebands and sending text images over waves and such. Is this similar to a sideband, or is this something, is digital, is it more akin to something that's happening in computers?
No, you're absolutely right, Tom. It's basically a sideband. So on the center of your channel, 90.7, you have your analog signal. And then out at 90.8 and 90.6, you broadcast these two lower power digital sidebands, and that's what contains the actual HD radio information. And that information can include audio, but it can also include things like pictures. There's a service that HD Radio has in it called Artist Experience, which allows a station to broadcast, say, album art. So while you're watching a song from an artist on your radio display, it pops up album art or information about the album itself. That can also provide various data services. One of the things that some HD radio stations are using this digital capacity for is for real-time traffic navigation services. So you're driving around the city, you can tune into an FM HD radio station that has traffic on it, and on your receiver you'll see a little map that shows where you are and where all the roads are that connect off and what the traffic is. So there's lots of different ways that information can be distributed via HD radio, and not all of them have to be the audio that we typically think of when we think of radio.
Are there many radio stations that are using their different sidebands for non-audio related? I guess some of them are probably doing video. Is video? I mean, or is it
not?
You can't do video through the radio.
No. There's just not enough capacity. I mean, because you're dealing with these compromised sidebands that don't really have a lot of space on the dial to accommodate them, there's only so much information that you can pass through. Probably one of the easiest ways of thinking about this is thinking about like the capacity of an internet connection at home, and it's like a cable or a DSL modem. You're getting several megabits per second worth of connectivity. That's why you can stream movies and download software and all kinds of other stuff, do email and surf the web and be on social media all at the same time, because the connection's fat enough and has enough capacity to support all of that. When you use your wireless phone, whether it's 3G or 4G connectivity, you're still dealing with a capacity to send and receive data that's measured in megabits, thousands of bits, millions of bits per second, right? HD television has its capacity measured in megabits. It can send something like 19 megabits per second of data. That's how it can send crystal clear video and really good sound and extra programming if it wants to. But the amount of capacity that HD radio contains is measured in kilobits. Thousands of bits per second. We're not even talking, we're talking somewhere near like dial-up modem capacity for sending digital information over the radio airwaves. So, yeah, I mean, the only thing that it can really do is send out a slightly better sounding stream. It can divvy up that stream into multiple channels, each one of which is compromised because it has to share the bandwidth, or it can send very rudimentary data, but television completely out of the picture. There's no way that HD radio could be used for something like that at this point in time.
It's closer to think of more of like a fax machine, and
yeah,
like the images we were talking about before, they come through in a very poor quality.
Yep.
And like in the way that a fax machine comes through with a very poor image, and so that's what we're talking about with the problem of trying to get so much information through us. Such a small straw or such a small hole is this exact problem. It's not made for multiple streams or multiple.
One of the things that we have to keep in mind when we're talking about HD radio is there's actually kind of like two flavors of it. The one that we're dealing with right now is called the hybrid system, and this is the one where the analog and digital radio signals are supposed to coexist. In the future, there is an all-digital HD radio protocol, and this would essentially mean getting rid of the analog signal completely and then using the extra capacity where the analog signal was to feed additional digital information. That does, quote-unquote, double the amount of carrying capacity for HD radio, but we're still talking, you know, high-speed dial-up modem level bandwidth capacity, still not really being able to provide any sort of breakthrough transformative feature to make radio something brand new and newly exciting in the 21st century.
You'd be creating 1990s radio is what you're saying.
Yeah, pretty much. And I think it's important to note that, you know, this technology was developed primarily in the 1990s when the world was a very different place. One of the things that radio broadcasting was very afraid of in the 1990s was the coming of satellite broadcasting. That was going to be all digital and it was going to be commercial free. And broadcasters were really, really concerned that this brand new digital satellite technology was going to eat its lunch.
There was a car element because the new cars were getting satellite radio systems, and that was where people were getting hooked, I guess.
Yep. Sirius and XM Radio, what they did is they basically paid auto manufacturers to put satellite radio receivers in their cars. And then they also subsidized the cost of a satellite radio subscription. So if you bought a new car, the first 6 to 12 months were free. Sirius and XM was just eating that cost in hopes that once your free trial period ran out, you would be able to, you would want to renew the subscription and actually pay the cost. And Sirius XM has since merged. They're now just one company. And they have a large enough subscriber base of about 25, 30 million people that they're profitable. So they don't really need to go out and seek other listeners unless they want to increase their profit margin. And that's a lot different from traditional over-the-air AM and FM broadcasting because that was designed to be a free service that was going to be ubiquitous and universal, available to every American.
It's so almost more like the British model, right, where you have to pay a license? Is that a...
Kind of. In the British model, everyone pays a license fee to support the British Broadcasting Corporation. In the Sirius XM model, you have to buy the receiver and agree to the subscription. So you're not forced simply because you have a radio to pay for Sirius XM. It's much more of a voluntary, commercial-driven thing. But, you know, back in the 90s, that was the big threat, and HD radio was kind of developed around that threat. And all of this was happening at a time when the internet was really starting to become a popular public thing. And broadcasting, by and large, was completely not even paying attention, just completely unaware of the notion that the internet was going to fundamentally transform the landscape of all media as we knew it. And so when HD radio finally came out of the skunk works and was up for consideration to be approved by the FCC to be rolled out publicly, there was all this other stuff going on regarding the internet that radio broadcasters weren't even paying attention to. And now, when you look back, that seems like it was a very bad strategic misstep to not realize the game-changing nature of what the internet was going to bring.
And they were fighting for all they could get in the Telecommunications Act of 1996 at the time, and they were more concerned about lobbying for those privileges they got out of that?
Yeah, well, the most important thing that radio broadcasters did when they developed HD radio, their number one goal was, we want to control our own digital transition. We don't want to go through what the TV broadcasters are going through, where they're going to have to get Congress involved and there's going to be all these external forces telling us what we should do as an industry. We're going to develop a technology that basically allows us to navigate the digital transition on our own terms. And in doing so, hopefully, and this is the broadcasters talking, and hopefully we can also prohibit new competition in this space. So that was kind of the selfish rationale behind developing and deploying the HD radio system. What the Telecommunications Act of 1996 did for radio was it opened up the industry to a massive amount of consolidation. That's where we get Clear Channel from. Before 1996, one company could only own something like 40 radio stations around the entire United States. By the end of that decade, Clear Channel owned something like 1,200 radio stations. And a lot of these companies, these conglomerates that formed following the Telecom Act, leveraged themselves on Wall Street. And so suddenly you had a radio industry that used to do 10, maybe $100 million of business, maybe more than that. Suddenly, with all the money that was involved in it, becoming a tens or hundreds of billions of dollar industry. And then
what that meant on the local level was that there were mom and pop radio operators that were basically forced out economically from being able to run stations because it was more profitable for these giant corporations to run many stations with automated programming than it was to have somebody locally bringing people in and actually talking to people in the community.
Yeah, so you have this big company come into your little town, and they're like, I'm going to buy a radio station for an exorbitant amount of money, you know, like millions of dollars for a small stick somewhere. And these little mom-and-pop broadcasters are like, okay, we can retire early. That's great. Then the company comes in, they look at how the radio stations run, and they immediately try to cut costs. We paid a lot for this radio station. We've taken a lot of debt. Now we need to recoup our investment. So what they did is they came in, fired a lot of the local talent, started automating and syndicating programming, which leads to kind of the homogenized cookie cutter mentality that you have right now.
And it's like the same time as the main streets of downtown were dying, the stations were like, instead of being on Main Street, they're kind of out in the suburbs and just an office where basically a computer is, and actually no one's actually working. There's just somebody, there's this computer picking up a feed from Los Angeles or something.
Yeah, in fact, people that used to work for Clear Channel back in those days openly compared their business model to Walmart or to McDonald's, right? You can go into a McDonald's anywhere in the world, or at least anywhere in the United States, okay? And the experience is pretty much going to be the same. The food is going to be at a certain level of quality. You can expect to pay a certain price. And that continuity of experience, that big box store kind of experience, was exactly what radio was going for.
You'll know you'll hear a Tom Petty song within 20 minutes somewhere
much.
On the dial.
Yes. And with all of that big money coming into the radio industry, at this critical time when HD radio was being developed as a technology, suddenly there was a lot of money available to start really lining up the industry's ducks in a row to go to the FCC and paint the picture that the radio industry had chosen its own digital transition mechanism and that they were ready to go. If it weren't for the Telecom Act and the large infusion of capital into the radio industry and the resultant conglomerates that fed on that capital, HD radio may have withered and died on the vine.
But instead, here we are today.
Yes.
So where it has withered and died basically without even vines.
Yeah, right. It's taken root in some areas. Like I said, the most notable feature of HD radio is the ability for FM stations to broadcast more than one program signal at the same time. And that is probably the most useful and most deployed feature of HD radio.
And so, what successful examples of that is, I guess, WNYC in New York. Did they have multiple?
You know, that's a good question. I don't think they do.
Who's a successful example of a station that does multiple programming?
That's a really good question because the commitment that radio stations make to multiple streams is hit and miss. There have been public radio stations and some community radio stations that have adopted HD, and what they do is they flip the programming back and forth between the two. So, for example, if your radio station is running music and you have news and public affairs in your schedule, during the time that music is on the main signal, there will be some news and public affairs running on the digital signal. And then when you do news and public affairs on your main signal, the music flips over to the digital. There have been some cases of, for example, college radio stations selling out to NPR selling their signals to public broadcasters, and then they put the student-run radio station on one of the digital signals. The important thing to remember is that you need an HD radio to pick up these digital-only signals. There have also been some cases in some major markets where, say, a professional sports team wants to have a 24/7 radio station devoted to their games and, you know, analysis or whatnot. And so they go and they lease one of these digital signals from a radio station. I think most interestingly, though, is the financial success of these signals are actually being found on the analog dial. What a lot of new adopters of HD radio are doing is they're putting up an HD radio signal on their main station, and then they're going out and they're either applying for or acquiring low-power FM transmitter stations. These stations are only like 250 watts max. They can't be live and local. They must run programming from another station.
That's the definition of a translator station, is a station that picks up a signal from a live station and translates it to a community that could not receive that signal.
Yep. And so what these broadcasters are doing is they put up an HD signal on their FM, their main FM station. Then they send out their main signal plus any extra digital streams they've got going on. Then they put translators around town, and each one of those translators is tuned to one of those digital signals. And it goes through the receiver and gets patched into the analog translator and comes out, and they're being marketed and positioned as, oh, look, brand new analog FM radio stations. And some of those translators that are being marketed as brand new standalone stations are actually finding some financial success. But what that does is it basically means it gives nobody, gives no listener an incentive to listen to the actual HD signal. And it also allows some stations or some companies like Clear Channel to circumvent local ownership caps. They can only own as many as 8 radio stations in any given market. And in many markets, Clear Channel already has that number of stations. But the FCC does not count low-power translator stations as real radio stations. So it basically is HD is being used as a backdoor for broadcasters to basically glom up more channels and have more radio stations under their belt.
And that's the best example of a use of HD radio is analog radio.
That is the most profitable example indeed, of HD radio, is using it to feed an analog transmitter.
Is that the most bizarre sentence that you've ever heard? I mean, how?
Well, it's really funny. I mean, the CEO of Ibiquity Digital Corporation, a guy by the name of Bob Struble, actually, he has a blog on the Ibiquity website called Thoughts on Radio's Future, and he doesn't update it that often, but but he did update it in 2013, and he basically wrote this whole post of like how, oh, look, this awesome backdoor way by which broadcasters can get more radio stations, this analog translator loophole, this is the big new thing, you should adopt HD radio because of it. But the problem is that...
So it's not 1990s, it's 1920s.
the problem is there's only so much spectrum to go around. And, you know, there's been a huge run on FM translator stations in the last decade. Translator stations themselves are selling for tens to hundreds of thousands of dollars a piece just because broadcasters want to misuse them like this. So it has created some sort of, you know, financial fun within the industry. It's been a growth area within the radio industry. But is it really doing something to bring radio into the 21st century? I don't really think so.
We've focused on some negative things. Can you tell us some positive things about HD radio? If someone gets an HD radio and starts listening, are they overwhelmed by the sound quality or the amount of choices? I guess we've already talked about it. It's not really that special, the programming.
That really depends on where you are. The sound quality difference between a regular analog radio signal and a digital radio signal is pretty remarkable on the AM band. We're used to hearing crackly static and lightning crashes and things like that whenever we try to tune into an AM signal. Plus, lots of modern electronics really mess up your radio receiver's ability to receive an AM signal. So the amount of noise that affects an analog AM signal is really bad these days. If you are able to get a strong lock on an AM HD radio signal, it sounds pretty much as good as FM radio does, which is pretty amazing. On the FM side, if you are able to get a lock on the primary HD radio signal, it can sound better than FM. Ubiquiti claims that it sounds pretty much qualitatively identical to a CD. I don't necessarily think that's the case, but it is an improvement. And depending on where you are in the market, in what market you're in the United States, yes, you will be able to find new program choices that you are not able to hear before. Some stations broadcast a derivative of their main format. So let's say they're a country music station. One of their extra programs they might run on a digital channel might be like classic country. I really miss, you know, Roger Miller and Boxcar Willie and, you know, Hank Williams and things like that. You don't hear that on regular country radio, but some stations are offering that on their digital signal.
But more often you're getting an unattended jukebox, right?
Yeah. There's one station in St. Louis, Missouri, that has actually taken one of their DJs off of their main signal and basically turned him into the program director to curate this new HD2 digital-only signal that they have. That's pretty cool. You can listen to it online. It sounds pretty...
I was going to say, does he have more listeners online than he has through HD? I mean, you can't tell that, can you? But
well, it's pretty interesting. There's a new measuring device that Arbitron, now Nielsen, uses called the Portable People Meter, PPM. And through these new monitoring technologies, you can actually tell whether someone's listening to an analog signal, a digital signal, or if they're listening online and things like that. But
this goes through the NSA?
I think probably yes, the NSA gets some of it. But it's a private company, Nielsen. The same people that do TV ratings are now in charge of radio ratings. And there hasn't really been any information that really breaks down the division between who's listening over the air versus who's listening over an internet connection. What I can say is that really about 2/3 of all radio stations in the United States stream online now. So there's still about 1/3 of all radio stations in the United States that do not stream. And some conglomerates have actually limited the amount of streaming users they can accommodate because it's pretty expensive to provide the bandwidth necessary to stream a radio signal on the internet and also to accommodate dozens, if not hundreds or thousands of listeners. So some broadcasters have actually taken a step back from streaming online. But I can't tell you that if you go to an industry convention, like the National Association of Broadcasters Convention, and you go to workshops and discussions about digital broadcasting, the majority of people are talking about streaming now. They're talking about ways to get on mobile phones and ways to position themselves in the brand new glass dashboards of new cars. There's really not a lot of discussion about HD radio and what it is and what it can do.
Because we're basically at that tipping point right now, right, where it used to be, you know, the satellite radio was the big competitor because it was in cars,
right.
And then HD, and then, you know, and then there was a big thing to get HD radio in cars because if we're going to do HD, you got to do it through cars. But now cars are going to be just like anywhere else. You're going to plug in your personal mobile device, whether it's a watch or glasses or a iPad or iPod or whatever it is, it's going to be something you plug in through probably an 1/8-inch cord, and there you go.
Yeah, the Consumer Electronics Show just ended, is wrapping up this weekend in Las Vegas, and that's kind of the annual pilgrimage that all tech journalists make to see what the crazy new gizmos are going to be and what the trends are in electronics and computing. And HD radio was there. But the largest buzz, if you want to put it about that, was the connected car. Cars are going to start coming with their own broadband internet access. And you'll be able to subscribe through like GM and AT&T for your own 4G internet package just for your car. And when that happens, suddenly all forms of entertainment and information start flooding into the vehicle. The kind of thing you're talking about where people are using their smartphones or their iPads as a bridge is the first step towards that. But
just for radio stations, it means that there's unlimited competition, that they don't have home field advantage anymore too much. They have a little home field advantage, but they don't have the total home field advantage that they once did.
Sure, back in the day, you know, you looked at your dashboard and there was the AM and FM radio and maybe a cassette deck or a CD player. And possibly maybe a USB place to plug in. Now you go into a brand new car, you're presented with a touch screen that has all these various options. You can watch DVDs, you can connect with various other quote-unquote forms of radio like Pandora or Last FM, which are essentially jukeboxes in and of themselves. And suddenly there isn't a place on the dashboard where it's immediate, where you just go hit radio. And in the minds of many people, many Americans, the whole concept of what about radio is has changed. And there is no standard design for what a dashboard looks like. If you go into a Ford, the dashboard looks different from, a Chevy, which looks different from an Audi. And where radio is in that menu is kind of a moving target. So, yeah, one of the places where radio has been dominant, they're not. Broadcasters are very quick to admit it. And what they're basically doing right now is playing catch up. We need to start looking like the other infotainment features that exist in the dashboard. And we need to start being potentially responsive to, if not what radio listeners want, at least what auto manufacturers want to see in those dashboards. Earlier in 2013, there was actually a scare where the publisher of Radio Inc. magazine, an industry publication, got online and was all like, the sky is falling. I just talked to some auto manufacturer, and they just told me that within 5 years, they're going to get rid of radio in cars. And it set off this whole crisis of confidence. And that's not true. Auto manufacturers will include radios in cars for the foreseeable future, primarily because it really doesn't cost them anything to include that feature in their car. And it's just one more feature that they can use to sell the car.
But compared to air conditioning or many other features that they offer, it's nothing.
Yeah, it's nothing, but it's another little piece of bling that you can put in the glass dashboard. So it's very simple and pretty painless for auto manufacturers to keep radio in their vehicles. And it's going to stay there for the foreseeable future. But that doesn't mean that radio listening in vehicles is going to grow anytime soon. In fact, it has been in decline pretty significantly over the last few years.
And if anything, radio corporations are fighting to get radio signals into phones and digital. I think, isn't the new iPhone going to have an FM receiver for the first time or something? Is that?
No, I haven't heard Apple making any steps towards embracing radio. There is an application. There are several applications out there that you can download that allow you to listen to the streams of radio stations that do stream online. One of the most, the largest of the bunch is called TuneIn, and that allows you to pick up thousands of radio stations from all around the world, but you're still using the internet connection to do it. So it affects your data plan that you have on your wireless device.
And that's a whole issue now, that with this net neutrality runaround that's proposed, that's basically going to mean that Clear Channel can cut a deal with Verizon to stream Clear Channel streams, but mom and pop independent station can't do that on their own.
Yeah, and that's a whole other area of policy which has immense implications, not just for broadcasting, but for the way we conceive of the internet and how it works. But most smartphones actually have a chip in them that will allow you to receive at least FM signals. Not all of them, but a significant portion of them do. And phone manufacturers and phone companies in the United States have basically opted to not enable that special chip. One phone company, Sprint, is now starting to do this. They offer a limited number of Android mobile phones that have the FM chip enabled. And they've worked out a deal with Emmis Communications, which is a mid-sized broadcast conglomerate based in Indianapolis, to pre-install an app on there called Next Radio. And effectively what Next Radio is it's a tuner app. So you can open it up and you can tune through your local radio dial using Next Radio. And if any of the radio stations are a participant in the Next Radio system, when you tune to that radio station, you will also see other information like album art, like song information, like information about the station, possibly an advertisement.
Is it still they're only web stream only stations or?
No, this is.
So it's more like Aereo kind of for radio?
Kind of, but basically what it does, I mean, the base functionality is it's an FM receiver for your rate, for your phone, right? So you turn it on, it enables the chip. The chip's already got to be turned on by the phone manufacturer and by the wireless carrier. But if the chip is enabled, you turn it on, boom, we are literally talking 20th century here. Wow, you can actually dial through the FM dial on your phone now. How wonderful is that? But if a station is part of the Next Radio family, if they've opted into using the app, you'll also see additional information about that station and about its program.
Oh, and that doesn't come in through the FM chip. That comes in simultaneously through digital means.
Yes, it does. That comes in.
That's what I was trying to figure out. How does that happen? Oh.
It's using that that digital connection. Now, if a station is broadcasting in HD, your phone can't receive an HD signal. The chips that are in smartphones right now only work for analog radio signals. There has been a prototype HD-equipped smartphone. One has been built. It was actually introduced at last year's Consumer Electronics Show, and it met with resounding disinterest. But it is important to get radio over the air broadcasting on the smartphone platform, and Next Radio gives them the capability to do that, at least in a rudimentary way. This is how far broadcasting industry has come when it comes to thinking about playing nice on other devices and on other mediums. I mean, most people don't buy radios anymore. They buy devices or vehicles or other things that happen to have radios in them.
All right, you're listening to Wave Farms WGXC 90.7 FM. It is the top of the hour. We're talking to John Anderson, the author of Radio's Digital Dilemma, Broadcasting in the 21st Century. And I guess this first hour we talked mostly about the period up until the 21st century. So maybe we'll talk about the future more in the second hour, John.
Sure.
Okay, we're going to go to the news, and then we'll be back in a few minutes. Stay tuned. We are back. It's the Saturday afternoon show. I'm Tom Rowe, live from the Wave Farm in Acre, and we have here via Skype is John Anderson, the author of the new book. I'm flipping around here. Radio's Digital Dilemma, Broadcasting in the 21st Century. Out now on Routledge. Is it out now, or did it just come out?
Yeah, I think it came out on like December 19th or something.
So just out. And why did you want to write this book?
Well, I used to be in the radio industry. I was a radio journalist in commercial radio news, and I was doing that in the 1990s. And after the 1996 Telecommunications Act happened, basically one of the casualties of consolidation was radio journalism. It takes a lot of people to do radio news, and that's something that takes a lot of money. So when large conglomerates like Clear Channel came in and were buying up stations left and right, one of the first things they axed was radio journalism. So right around the turn of the millennium, there was also an FCC proceeding going on to create a brand new low-power FM community radio service. And I got involved in that, and that was kind of a radicalizing thing for me. I was also involved in electronic civil disobedience, unlicensed broadcasting, micro radio, which was very instrumental in getting the FCC to approve this new low-power FM community radio service. And after all those important decisions were made to actually launch LPFM, I decided to leave commercial radio and go back to graduate school to basically figure out, you know, what the hell had happened to the industry that I thought I was going to be spending my life working for. And throughout the process of seeing what the FCC was up to and investigating the state of radio in the United States, I started hearing more about this digital radio technology, and I started looking into it and realized that it wasn't everything that it was claimed to be, that the process by which it had been developed and approved was fraught with difficulty. And I thought, huh, this is a really interesting story. Why don't I investigate this story? And I started literally writing about it on my blog at DIYmedia.net. Oh, look, I found this piece of information. Here's another piece of information. And then I started putting all the pieces together and realized this is a pretty significant development in broadcasting history. So I wrote the book essentially to chronicle this constitutive moment where the future of radio broadcasting in the United States was developed, and the rationales and values that went into developing the HD radio system that we have today. So it's a book of history, insta-history, contemporary history. It's a book about how the industry works. It's a book about how new technologies are developed. But most importantly, I think it's a book about media policy and the values that are inscribed in modern media policy and the policy-making process.
So, my mic has fallen over here. Where are we now with digital radio? So the public doesn't know much about it. It's not widely adopted. The industry is ignoring it. Does it have a future? I mean, is you talked about AM before. I thought maybe that would be an interesting place to talk. There's a FCC commissioner these days who's made it his bailiwick to try to bring back AM radio and... is this one way to save AM radio, that where the sound quality is very poor to begin with?
Doubtful. It's pretty doubtful that HD radio is going to be AM broadcasting's saving grace. The commissioner you're talking about is Ajit Pai. He's one of the Republican members of the FCC, and he actually grew up in Kansas. Where obviously you can get a lot of AM radio signals. And so he's kind of looking back at, I used to listen to baseball games when I was a kid. Oh, how come we can't have that kind of thing on the air anymore? And it's been through his tireless promotion of this effort that the FCC has actually launched a proposed rulemaking called the AM Revitalization Initiative. And it's considering a bunch of different ways by which we could help AM broadcasting achieve more listenership and more relevance in the 21st century. Many of the ideas that are being discussed in the Revitalization Initiative have nothing to do with digital radio. Actually, a lot of them have to do with potentially migrating all AM radio stations over to the FM band and simply doing away with the FM band entirely. And this is actually something that other countries are in the midst of doing. Mexico is actually in the process of migrating all of its AM radio stations over to the FM dial. The United Kingdom has deployed its own digital radio technology, the European standard, and they're looking, again, to migrate AM stations over to FM, and they've actually declared 2017 to be the year when they hope to get rid of all analog radio completely. Here in the United States, one of the things that the FCC suggested as potentially a more long-term solution for the problems of AM radio is digital radio. And they've at least left that open as a potential option to pursue in the future. As of now, the AM Revitalization Initiative has received a grand total of 44 comments At the Federal Communications Commission. The first round of public comments on this initiative are due at the end of this month.
What does that compare to the cell phones on airplanes comments?
Right. Not even close. And most of the people that have filed comments in that initiative so far are independent broadcasters or broadcast engineers. And the majority of them, when they do mention digital radio, they're saying things like, please don't make it mandatory to adopt HD radio on the AM band. HD radio does cause interference to AM radio stations. Actually, the interference problem between the analog and digital signals is worse on the AM dial than it is on the FM dial. And some of them have actually suggested that the FCC reopen the notion of considering alternatives to HD radio. I mean, since 1990, when HD radio really started to put down roots, there have been other digital broadcast technologies that have been developed, some of which are getting some traction elsewhere in the world. And the great thing with new electronics devices is you can actually put one chip in a device, and that chip is capable of receiving analog, HD, and other forms of digital radio. I think it's unlikely that the FCC will look at all digital AM broadcasting as a saving grace for AM broadcasters as a whole, partially because in order to accommodate all the digital broadcasts, not all AM radio stations will be able to adopt them. Some AM radio stations' transmission infrastructures are old and cobbled together and honestly don't work well with new digital radio signals. There was a study done in the early 2000s saying that, you know, if AM broadcasting were to go all digital, something like, you know, 100 stations would have to go off the air simply because they could not configure their transmitters to put across a viable AM digital signal. So no, it's not a be all and end all. While the end state for HD radio will ultimately be the cessation of analog broadcasts like the one most people are listening to right now, that's going to be years, if not decades, away.
And why are the British able to make the transition quicker? They're the first country that's really going all digital?
The United Kingdom was the first country in Europe to adopt the European standard. They've basically been dealing with digital broadcasting since about 1986, 1987. And again, they're using a completely different technology, which uses a new chunk of spectrum, so it doesn't do anything to existing analog AM and FM signals. The other thing to keep in mind is the industry makeup of broadcasting in the United Kingdom. The BBC is kind of the 800-pound gorilla. The commercial side of the radio industry, it has really only been around for the last 20, 30 years. So it doesn't have the same kind of political and economic clout as the BBC does. And as goes the BBC, so goes the rest of the British radio industry. So since the BBC is a government chartered corporation, it's worked closely with regulators to determine the steps by which radio's digital transition will be made there. And much like over here in the United States, their technology is not finding a huge amount of purchase. More people are listening to digital broadcasts in the UK than in the US, that's for sure. And there's a lot more support by companies that make radio receivers to make digital radio receivers in the UK. But it's a slow process. And one of the main reasons why it's so slow is because radio listeners don't really see digital radio technology as being this gotta have thing. They're happy or at least satisfied with analog radio service. And so there really isn't a large demand by the public to go out and really engage in and buy in to this new digital radio system. But eventually it will happen. And it will probably happen long before the United States conducts its own bona fide, full-throated digital radio transition.
And I don't think we really explained in detail the difference between the United States' approach to digital radio and the rest. Is it the rest of the world or just Europe? Is it like metric? They're on the metric system and we're on...
Kind of. I mean, the European system was actually a jointly developed technology. So the UK was involved, France was involved, and Germany was involved. And scientists and all those three companies basically developed a consortium to create the technology and to promote the technology. And since there's been a lot of coordination on that level, they've had a little bit more success in getting broadcasters to adopt their digital technology than we have. The other thing to remember is the European standard doesn't come with all of these additional perpetual licensing fees like the Ubiquiti HD radio system does. And that's been the primary thing that stopped broadcasters from adopting it here. They just can't see the value. They can't see the return on investment in paying some company effectively in perpetuity to run a digital radio signal. Margins in radio broadcasting are thin already. They've gotten thinner as listeners begin to migrate to other forms of audio entertainment. And they can't see the financial rationale for doing it. So if Ubiquiti were to get rid of their entire licensing business model, for broadcasters in the United States, I think you would probably see a lot more interest among broadcasters, at least looking at the technology, if not necessarily adopting it outright.
And what would that change?
First of all, it would basically just mean that radio stations would have to invest in the equipment, just like you would for any station upgrade, right? And any money that you would make off of it, or at least at the least, there wouldn't be any residual additional costs to running the radio station like there is in the current HD radio business model. Ubiquiti, for the longest time, have said that the majority of their revenue is going to come from the receiver side. Companies that make HD receivers also have to pay a percentage of all of the sales that they make to Ubiquiti Digital Corporation. And there's only 15,000 radio stations in the United States, but there's hundreds of millions of potential radio receivers out there. So you can see, like, the arithmetic works out really well on using the license model on the receiver side. If Ubiquiti was just to write off their broadcast income stream, I don't think that would materially affect the company in any way, shape, or form. It's not profitable. Ubiquiti's never been profitable. They are still existing on infusions of money from venture capitalist investors who expect the technology to take off in the future. But at the very least, that would be a huge jumpstart for getting broadcasters interested in potentially adopting the technology.
Excuse me. So, is it cost? Have you done any study, or has anyone done any study? Does it cost more to have a second content stream through Ubiquiti, or does it cost more to start your own web internet stream?
Ah, that's a really good question, and nobody has actually done like a cost comparison on that. I mean, if you're a broadcaster and you want to adopt HD radio, you're going to need to invest tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars in your radio station in order to make the technology work properly. The vast majority of that money comes in costs not directly related to HD radio. In order to broadcast an analog and digital signal, for example, you need to have more power running to your transmitter. The broadcasting of the digital signal itself is actually very power inefficient. And there are some full power FM radio stations, after adopting HD, have had to budget twice as much for electricity. They need to budget more for cooling at their transmitters in order to keep everything nice and cool in order to broadcast in digital. On top of that, you may be using different types of digital audio files in your programming. One thing is a WAV file, another thing is an MP3 file, You might pull something off of YouTube. And we mix all those digital audio systems together in one program stream and then feed it through the HD radio system, it can sound really crappy. So one of the things that you might have to do as a radio station to adopt HD is consolidate and make sure that all of the programming that you play is all in one file format. And doing that is an additional cost. When it comes to the technology itself, you have to buy an HD radio transmitter. You have to reconfigure your antenna system in order to accommodate the new digital signals. And then you also have to pay the licensing fees to Ubiquiti. Right now, that's a one-time $10,000 fee. And then if you use these additional services, like the ability to send out multiple digital streams, Ubiquiti expects a residual cut, a percentage of your income from those features forevermore. Now, if you're looking to stream, you obviously have to buy computers. You have to have an internet connection that's robust enough in order to handle whatever listener base that you want. And you also have to pay the performance rights fees to the record labels in order to stream content online, copyrighted content online. Over the course of several years, that cost will eventually accrue to a significant amount. But the startup cost of putting a stream on the air is not nearly as high as it is to adopt HD radio. So in the short term, yes, it's actually cheaper for radio stations to go. Over the longer term, do those costs balance out? Nobody really knows.
Why wouldn't Ubiquiti want widespread adoption? You know, why wouldn't they be giving radios, giving radios away to people to get this started? Because they need to have a mass audience to have a mass audience. It seems to me, is no one's interested in it because no one's interested in it, and there's nothing there to be interested in.
Yeah. Okay. Well, first thing is that, you know, because the system is completely proprietary, that means that some of the HD radio technology is locked in a black box to which only Ubiquiti has the key. And having such control over its intellectual property, much again like Microsoft, is the primary way by which Ubiquiti expects to make money, by leveraging their control over the intellectual property of HD radio. If you were to break that black box, make it a little bit more open for people to tinker with and to innovate with, you're damaging the fundamental business model of Ubiquiti. And it appears, at least right now, that Ubiquiti would rather own all of nothing than something than some part of something, right? The other thing is that Ubiquiti itself, the corporate history behind it, is that it was a merger of two other companies which were primarily financed by broadcasters. And in Ubiquiti's early years, it didn't have a lot of people on staff. Most of the people that were working for Ubiquiti were actually on loan from other broadcast conglomerates who had invested in Ubiquiti. So Ubiquiti does not have a huge amount of money that they can throw around to give away free radios or to entice auto manufacturers to put HD radio in their cars, much like satellite broadcasters have. It's always been kind of wobbling along on infusions of money from its investors. That's been just enough to keep the company solvent.
It doesn't seem like venture capital is pouring into radio, especially when a radio project that has so many questions surrounding it.
Exactly. And so because of that, the best that Ubiquiti and broadcasters can do essentially is to devote free airtime to spots that basically promote how awesome HD radio is. That's
on,
pretty much
on stations that are, you're already listening to.
Yeah, right.
Because you don't hear ads for HD radio on analog stations.
If you want to get on Google, there's a blog post that I have called "Whack Spots Promote HD Radio." Back in back in 2006, Clear Channel's Creative Services Division. 2006 was kind of the heyday of broadcaster adoption of HD radio. It's actually been in significant decline since then. But back in that 2006, Clear Channel's Creative Services Division put together a campaign of radio commercials that supposedly promoted the wonderful things that HD radio could do. And the spots were an unmitigated disaster. They didn't really say anything.
Wait, it looks like I might not be able to play them on the air.
Oh, really? No, that's too bad. I mean,
no, I just mean from an indecency standpoint.
Totally. On an indecency standpoint, you can get away with actually playing all of them. I mean, if you've got them pulled up, try the one about farts. That one's good. But okay, go ahead. That one is Clear Channel's way of demonstrating.
I deaf radio.
Are you deaf yet? All right, that was it, Derek.
Yeah. So basically on normal radio, farts do not sound as juicy as they do on HD radio. It's kind of the listener's takeaway of that spot. There's another one about the new programming that you can hear on HD radio. That's also pretty hilarious. They haven't done a very good job of making the case to anybody why this is the brand new world of 20th century broadcasting.
Is this a giant lost opportunity?
Yes. In many ways, radio has still not been able to figure out a place for itself in this brand new convergent media environment that we have, which seems to be kind of harmonizing all different types of technologies onto a single universal platform, which today we identify as the internet. We don't know what the platform of the future is going to be. Instead, broadcasters have kind of become extremely insular, and they've essentially been protecting their own turf and making sure that no new competitors can be in the game. And for all of the money and time that has been invested in developing and promulgating HD radio, just imagine if all of that money and time had been invested in developing platforms and content which actually meant something, right? Even with HD radio itself, there are ways by which broadcasters could utilize the technology in order to serve the public interest better. If they're not willing to invest, for example, in broadcasting brand new digital-only program streams, why don't they donate those channels to communities and other groups that cannot get a license for themselves? This is something that has been suggested over and over and over by various media policy activists, and the industry, basically through greed and hubris, won't hear anything about that. They won't consider that as being a potential place by which they could develop new interest in HD radio.
And what I understand is you could have a second music station and a third talk station, quality wise. Is that the kind of concept?
Yeah, you can have in the all-digital FM system, you can have as many as 8 different program streams run on one FM channel. In the current hybrid analog and digital system that we have right now, it maxes out at about 3 or 4 total streams, one of them being the primary stream and then the other 2 or 3 being these additional streams. So, for example, I live in Brooklyn, right? And Brooklyn, in the neighborhood in which I live, it's Afro-Caribbean. Lots of people from the Dominican Republic, Haiti, places like that. Brooklyn also happens to be the hotspot for pirate broadcasting in the United States. And if you listen, if I tune through my FM dial here in Brooklyn, I can hear 11 different pirate radio stations. And the majority of them are, surprise, Afro-Caribbean, right? They're Haitian broadcasters that are holding talk shows, that are dealing with issues in their community. They're sponsoring live music shows at local clubs. They're providing low-cost advertising for local businesses. Well, the broadcasters, you know, the broadcast industry hates pirate radio because there's all these stations on the air that don't belong, and they can cause interference, blah, 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 blah. Well, if broadcasters wanted to turn around and say, hello, Afro-Caribbean community, here's a free digital radio station that can be heard throughout the city of New York. All you have to do is set up a studio and feed us programming, and we'll handle the rest. Could you imagine what that might do for both diversity on the airwaves and also for the stature of local broadcasters who have kind of jettisoned the whole concept of providing live, local, community service in exchange for profit maximization through consolidation.
Right, so, and if you brand it all right, then other stations that FM station is making would be like the best friends of those people that are, you know, you're giving them a station.
Absolutely.
They're going to love your other stations too.
Absolutely. So there are lots of different ways by which we could be using this new capacity to actually advance the notions of public interest, convenience, and necessity as stewards of the airwaves. But broadcasters simply won't hear it. And to tell you the truth, I think most people that have adopted HD radio are pretty happy with the status quo. You know, the FCC is not breathing down their neck trying to make them do a bunch of other stuff. There is no new competition on the AM and FM dials really to speak of. And so as long as the status quo is maintained, that's a good business proposition.
Are broadcasters today more open to an idea like giving away a channel of frequency because it's a model that they've seen work over the internet in the past decade?
No. Broadcasters are basically still telling people who want access to the airwaves, go to the internet and do that. Do it yourself there. This has been a recurring theme both in the policy discussion over HD radio and also within the industry. No, unfortunately, this has not been one of the options that they're considering as a way to engender a new interest in what is already a very old technology.
Is the broadcast industry closest? How would you compare it to the newspaper industry, to the movie industry is going through? The local movie owners have to convert to digital right now, and a lot of mom and pop movie owners and drive-in theaters are having problems. Where would you make the comparison media-wise?
Well, you know, radio is the last of the legacy analog mass media systems to really kind of navigate this whole notion of convergence and the notion that suddenly you don't have your own little exclusive playground of the public airwaves where people can receive your content. And because of that, I would hope that broadcasters have learned lessons from watching the troubles of newspapers and the troubles of television stations and things like that. But it doesn't seem like they have. You have to remember that, you know, the radio business is still, even though profit margins are thin, it's still immensely profitable. It's more profitable than, you know, local big box retail stores. Walmart runs, you know, largest employer in America, runs on a profit margin of around 3%. Whereas in broadcasting, that profit margin is in the teens to 20%. So it's still an immensely profitable medium. And again, as long as the money keeps flowing in, as long as advertisers still see value in advertising on radio, you are going to see the same types of business practices continue in the industry for the foreseeable future.
How do you see this digital story in the larger story of radio in general? Is it a symptom of a larger disease, or is it a separate problem that doesn't really matter that much, or is it huge? You know, how does it fit in?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Tom. I think it's a symptom of a larger disease. Bob McChesney, a very famous media scholar, wrote a pretty fundamental book back in the 1990s called Telecommunications, Mass Media, and Democracy. And basically what that book chronicled was the political, technological, and economic decisions that were made in order to create the system of broadcasting that we have today. And the most important takeaway from McChesney's work is that the most important thing that the FCC did when it created radio broadcasting as a as an industry in the United States was it classified it as an industry. It was not a public service. It was a money-making venture. And if you look at the promulgation of media policy since 1930s, you see that the media is a business. In the 1980s was the time when that whole concept became really primary. Media decisions were made primarily, almost exclusively, through an economic lens. It didn't matter if there were social goods at hand. It was whether or not did this make economic sense. And HD radio, its development, both as a technology and as a policy, really takes that to heart. It's the most pure expression of economics running a media system that we've ever seen. And it also represents the tragedy of regulating a media system through the lens of economics, because it screwed up the reasoning behind why we needed HD radio. Just a quick example. When the large broadcasters who wanted HD radio went to the FCC and said, you should adopt this technology, the FCC asked them, why should we adopt this technology? And HD radio's proponent said, because we control the majority of industry revenue. And those of us who control the majority of radio industry revenue obviously know what's best for the radio industry as a whole, because we control the money, right? And the FCC, long enamored with economics, turned around and said, you know, that math makes complete sense, right? But what the FCC didn't take into consideration was those who control the majority of industry revenue do not control the majority of radio stations in America. They only control about 20% of radio stations in America. So essentially, by making the case that this was the future for radio, they were essentially kicking 80% of broadcasters to the curb. And those people still believe that media and media regulation should mean something more than money and something more than economics. So the story of HD radio is in many ways kind of the capstone of the privatization of broadcasting that Bob McChesney wrote about and that started 80 years ago. And so in that way, it's a pretty significant point and a pretty significant moment in the history of media and media regulation in the United States. And unfortunately, until this book came out, nobody knew it was happening. Something that completely happened under everybody's noses, including many of us in the know.
How do you think, why do you think this industry gets so little attention from the media?
Because it's the media, stupid.
it's not necessarily just the radio industry. It's they're not covering anything.
No, I mean, you know, television broadcasters couldn't care less about what's happening in the radio industry. And the radio industry is certainly not going to provide comprehensive or much less critical coverage of something that's not working in their favor. A really good example of this happened back when the Telecommunications Act of 1996 was actually passed. There was no reporting on the Telecom Act and what it meant for broadcasting, what it meant for the media system more largely on any of the major TV news networks. And on the day that it was signed into law by Bill Clinton, I can't remember if it was NBC or ABC News, but one of them actually made a mention of it on the air. They said, you know, Bill Clinton signed the Telecommunications Act in 1996. It's the most sweeping reform of media regulation in the United States in the last 50, 60 years, right? And then the anchor turns around and says, because our parent corporation was involved in this, we really can't go into any more detail about what the act did because we as journalists are trying to maintain our objectivity. Right. So here's one of these cases where the people that pay the journalists paychecks are doing all this crazy stuff, which in retrospect actually harmed the democratic potentiality of our media system. But the media system wouldn't cover it because it was not in the best financial interests or economic interests of the industry as a whole. So I'm not surprised that most people don't know what HD radio is. Most broadcasters could care less about it. And outside of really the radio industry trade press, there's been hardly any talk of HD radio. And when it is, it's confused and underwhelming. Once people actually get the chance to listen to HD radio, they turn around and say, what's the big deal?
And I guess it's important to say at this point, well, in this country, in the United States, in this case, every decision was made by dollar signs rather than social good or what's the best decision. Other countries have taken the public airwaves and treated them differently and treated them as something that wasn't just an industry that you could turn over a printing press to a handful of corporations, but something that came with it some public responsibilities because you're on public land or airwaves.
Yes. For example, in the UK, where they've adopted the European Digital Radio Standard, they've actually carved out channel spaces within the new digital radio regime to provide access to groups that have never had a radio station before.
So public access radio?
Some of that, but also more along the lines of serving communities that have not had access to the airwaves, specifically communities that speak in foreign languages, right? So, for example, in London, the BBC has an Asian service, which provides music from Asia, provides news from various countries. And if you are of that demographic, you know that from like 4 to 6, you can tune in and you can hear Korean stuff. And then from 6 to 8, you can tune in and hear stuff from Japan or, you know, Sri Lanka or wherever, which has provided new communicative aspects and new community-generating aspects that the traditional broadcast regime couldn't accommodate. So they are using digital radio in order to provide increased public access to the airwaves. And we're not seeing any of that here in the United States, unfortunately.
Are there any pirates that use digital technology, HD technology?
Well, it depends on where you are. In the United States, no, because it would essentially involve getting a cracked copy of the Ubiquiti software.
There's another set of frequencies. You can get a license to be a radio broadcaster on a place on the dial that there are no radios for. But I mean, you can buy the radios. They're kind of expensive, and have your own little personal radio network.
Sure.
So that's what basically HD radio is.
Yeah, but in order to play with the system, you have to pay for it.
You have to pay the licenses.
Yeah, you have to pay to license it. So, like, let's say you had a friend who was an engineer at a local radio station that gave you a copy of the Ubiquiti operating system, right? You'd still have to go out and buy the transmitter in order to install that software on. And then if Ubiquiti found out that your friend gave you a copy of their software, they could come back and yank both of you off the air. They'd yank you off the air for using a hacked copy of their software, but they would also yank your friend's radio station off the air because they gave an unauthorized copy of that software to you. Now, in the European system, yes, actually, there has been some experimentation with people putting up unlicensed, low-power digital radio transmitters. And this has just only started within the last year, because even though the European system was a lot more open, or is a lot more open than HD radio, it still had some patents on it. So there was still an initial cost in order to use the software. It was not nearly as severe as Ubiquiti, and there as Ubiquiti system is, and there are also not residual costs that you have to pay in order to use it. So there's a guy in the UK who basically hand built his own little digital radio transmitter, hand built an antenna, put it up on a rooftop, put the software in, configured it, and was doing an experimental broadcast. And after he got done with that this spring, he turned in a white paper to the regulators at the UK and said, hey, look, here's a new way by which we might be able to use this digital technology to provide community level service. I can do it in a way that it doesn't interfere with the larger digital broadcasters. So, hey, why don't you give it a shot? It's not something that's been widely adopted. It's still extremely experimental. But here in the United States, no, you got to pay to play. And if you can't pay, then how do you play?
So, is that the future? I was going to ask, is if Ubiquiti can't pay, are they eventually going to go bankrupt and there's going to be pirated copies of this ghost software from the past?
No, I think one of three things is going to happen. The first thing is eventually the malaise of the status quo, the fact that HD radio is just kind of lingering out there and nothing's really happening. The longer that continues, the more of a crisis it will become for broadcasters who are seeking that all digital footprint in our convergent media environment. So one thing that may happen in a few years is the FCC will actually entertain the notion of forcing all radio stations in the United States to adopt HD radio. If that comes to pass, it will be incredibly contentious, and the outcome may result in a system of HD radio that does not look a lot like what we have today. The other option is that broadcasters who are outside of the Ubiquiti system, in conjunction with the FCC and in conjunction with radio listeners and the general public, might be able to convince the FCC to open up the exploration of digital radio to other technologies. That would not be as disruptive as it sounds because, like I said, the technology exists on the receiver side to build a receiver that can handle any digital radio signal. That's unlikely, but it's not out of the realm of possibility. And the third thing that could happen is, you know, the FCC could come for the radio spectrum just like they have for the TV spectrum. Like we were talking about earlier, the analog TV spectrum is now being reproportioned and will eventually be auctioned off to wireless phone companies to expand the reach and capacity of wireless broadband internet access. Now, the AM dial is not a very good space of spectrum to try to do that on. The FM dial is an okay space. It's not optimal, but, you know, 5 or 10, 15 years from now, the technology might be there to make FM spectrum suddenly very useful for wireless broadband. And the FCC could turn around to the broadcast industry in 10 years and say, listen, you don't have your stuff together. The majority of people are listening to radio online anyway, so why don't we just take all that spectrum back and repurpose it to use it for other things? And if that were to happen, that would obviously be one of the most radical, transformative notions of radio that's ever to come down the pike in U.S. broadcast history. But more importantly, it would mean that radio would finally reach convergence because they would no longer have their own transmission network. You'd be just like every other internet broadcaster. And those are kind of the three potential resolutions to the malaise of HD radio as it exists right now. But again, this is a developing story, and it's going to stay in flux for the foreseeable future. And if anybody tells you they know what the future is going to bring in this case, they're full of it.
All right. Well, we'll have to end there with everyone can come up with their own dystopian or utopian future as in terms of what digital radio will sound like 5 or 10 years from now, or if will sound at all, or if we'll be using some other term besides radio for it. We'll see. All right. Again, John, give all the information about the book, a website and stuff like that. Where can people get it?
Sure. The book is called Radio's Digital Dilemma, Broadcasting in the 21st Century. It's being published by Routledge. You can look it up on Amazon. It's on there as well. And if you're interested in learning more about the book and more about like the research that's gone into the book, I'd strongly suggest you check out my blog. It's at diymedia.net. There you can find more information about the book as well as all of the context that kind of makes the book important, at least in my selfish author's mind. The bad news is the book is extremely expensive right now because Routledge is targeting the library market and they're only publishing it in a very glossy hardcover. So I'm suggesting that if people want to support the book, obviously you can buy it. That would be great. But more importantly, you might want to contact your local libraries, or you can actually do this through the Routledge website. You can actually submit a form to have them contact your local library to acquire a copy. If 200 of these hardcover copies are sold, that will automatically trigger an affordable paperback run. And so far, about 50 copies have been sold in the last 3 weeks, which doesn't sound like a lot, but for academic texts, that's actually a huge accomplishment. So I have my fingers crossed. But yeah, if you want to know more, Routledge.com or Amazon.com or DIYmedia.net.
All right. Thanks again, John Anderson. And again, we mentioned that he's vice president on the Wave Farm board, for full disclosure. And thanks so much for Skyping in today.
Thanks for having me on, Tom. It's been great.
All right. We will go out with a little William Baczynski and remind everyone to head over to the Catskill Community Center at 8 p.m. tonight till 10. And then we'll head to Chicago after that for NERF B Radio. Stay tuned.
The preceding show was recorded at Wave Farm's WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.